Dr. Talia Murin-Schatz is a leader in research at the intersection of medicine and behavioral economics. She is professor and founding director of the Center for Medical Decision Making, Tuano Academic College in Israel, senior fellow at the Center for Medicine and the Public Interest in New York, and a visiting researcher at the Winton Center for Risk and Evidence Communication at the University of Cambridge. She was a postdoctoral researcher at Princeton and a lecturer at Wharton. She's the author of over 60 academic papers on medical decision-making and the author of the new book titled Your Life Depends on It, What You Can Do to Make Better Choices About Your Health. Talia, welcome.
Hey.
So your book is around making better choices around our own health and healthcare. And why do you think it's such a critical time to have this conversation?
I think it's always a critical time to have this conversation because you should always take really good care of your health. But especially now with COVID, I think that's like through medical decision-making and health choices right to the center of our life. It isn't going away anytime soon. So particularly now for the past, I don't know how many months and looking into the future, it's crucial.
I agree. And look, we believe in information and being educated and its empowerment. But, you know, there's Dr. Google. Mm-hmm. And I struggled with this. I don't think I'm alone. When you're faced with a choice around your own health, maybe you're not feeling so well or you're trying to be proactive or something, and you go to Dr. Google, and information can be empowering, but information can also cause you to spiral. How do you think about Dr. Google, if you will, and how Dr. Google plays a role in our decision-making when it comes to our own health and healthcare?
I think like many things, it's complicated. So on one hand, the availability of Dr. Google, just having so much health information available and accessible is wonderful. It's great. On the other hand, you have to take it with a grain of salt. And I want to say that with two aspects. One is we really need to figure out who is saying what we're listening to. So is this the Mayo Clinic or is this the mayonnaise clinic? If you will, that recommends of just put mayonnaise on everything and then we become healthy. So is this a credible source? Is this a good idea? Is there any data supporting this or is it just someone's opinion? And that's actually really hard. That's an exercise that almost in going against ourselves. And I do a lot of work as a consultant in the digital health space and pharma, et cetera. And I know that as people, we like to think very simply. We like simple answers. They're great. They're great because they reduce our cognitive effort. That we love that. But as we seek Dr. Google and Dr. Google's friends from various sources, we really need to say, are they good friends of ours? Can I trust them? Is this for real? So that's the first thing, is just look at the credibility of the source. The second thing is, does this make any sense? Is this probable? And let me give you an example. So a while ago, years ago, I heard that soy milk is really good for you. So I shifted my daily cappuccino to soy milk. A couple of days later, I had a bitterness in my mouth and it wouldn't go away. And I brushed my teeth, it wouldn't go away. I had mint, it wouldn't go away. What do? I Google, right? So I Google bitterness in mouth. I'm like, oh my God, I have cancer. That was one of the symptoms. Like, okay. It was good while it lasted. I'm like really saying goodbye to the world. It's really, I'm an idiot, but I'm happy to share that because I think it's a very common experience. And then I thought, wait a minute, before you decide you have cancer, try to find a simpler solution. What's happening? What's going on with your life? What has changed recently? What has changed recently is that I switched to soy milk. I went off of soy milk. The bitterness went away. The cancer, the pretend cancer went away. So that's, I think, is a great example of both having available information and then needing to have some common sense around it to not just say, I read it online, therefore it must be true and apply to it.
And reading things online has also become more complicated because some of those most trusted sources, you know, during COVID, we were we were wrong a lot. I'll leave it at that. And we were wrong a lot. There was also a lot of misinformation out there to navigate through, but that is a challenge. The other challenge is television. There are all those, and you talk about this in the book, I love it. There are all these great medical dramas, but not so good when it comes to learning. They're not exactly educational, right?
Exactly. Because you know what? When you sit in the hospital, you want to push the forward button because it's very like, why am I waiting here for 3 hours? This doesn't happen on TV. Well, guess what? This is real life. And in real life, getting results takes time. Getting decisions takes time. There's a longer time lag between the time you get to the ER and the time you get treated. And we don't see that on TV. So TV is dramatized. It's very convincing. Again, it's compelling. You see it, and seeing is believing. So you see things that happen, for example, CPR, and that's an example that I talk about a lot in the book. When you see CPR online, I love demonstrating CPR because someone who gets CPR on TV, usually they're young, they're hot, they fell off a scooter or were hit by, I don't know, thunder, something really exotic happens to them. Then they come to and their girlfriend, super hot, comes and gives them a kiss. That's CPR. So everybody wants CPR, right? It's so cool and so successful. It's really not the same way in real life. It usually happens to people who are already very sick. They're already in the hospital, don't necessarily have a very hot girlfriend, and they will not necessarily hug their girlfriend and ride their scooter on the way out of the hospital. They're much more likely to remain in the hospital for a few weeks afterwards, sometimes with complications coming from CPR, like broken ribs or an infection. The stuff that doesn't look good on TV, therefore you will never see it on TV. So I think it's such a wonderful example. And TV is like, I wrote a section and I called it Learning All the Wrong Things from George Clooney, because he used to be on ER. And it's like, you see it and you believe it. And then you have to stop yourself and say, that's great as TV drama, but I have to remember this isn't real life.
You know, ultimately, your book is about empowering us to make better choices. How can us patients, I'm sure we have some doctors and practitioners out there listening too, but focus on us patients, us consumers. How can we do a better job of setting up the doctor-patient relationship for success?
Right. That's a great question. I want to rephrase it a bit. Not us patients, us people. You're just a person, right? You don't necessarily have a disease or a condition. You don't necessarily think of yourself as a patient. Maybe you're a mom, maybe you're a dad. You have to cater to your children's health. Maybe you're just feeling quite all right, but you have to make sure you continue feeling like that. So a few crucial things. The first one is the word you used, relationship. That's super important. Without a relationship, without trust in our physicians, we have absolutely nothing. So we have to make sure that we are in a relationship with someone we trust, who listens to us, and who conveys information to us in ways we understand. This is crucial. That's the first step. It has nothing to do with how much you exercise or whether or not you take your pills. It's just about that level of trust. We have absolutely nothing. It's fascinating because I work a lot in the digital health space and with health advertisers, et cetera, and with wonderful people who try to build wonderful platforms for patient support. And that's always the first step. So if you don't have relationship and trust, you have nothing. That's the first thing. The second thing, and I write about that repeatedly, is to know that it's hard to understand medical information. It's just hard. It's a language we don't necessarily speak. It's not necessarily being delivered to us in ways that we understand. And it's okay to ask. It's fine and legitimate to not understand. And it's your job to ask and to inquire. So we sometimes feel stupid, you know, what did they say? I don't know, right? It's like, I'll figure it out later. No, figure it out now. Figure it out now. Write it down now. I interviewed a physician about her experiences as a patient. And she was talking. I didn't want to cut her off. I also felt embarrassed to ask her when she mentioned various names of diseases. So it turned out that the only thing I got right was bronchitis. I got everything else wrong, like literally everything. but I had written it down. So I had a messed up version and I could figure it out. Had I not written it down, I would have been left with nothing. I mean, one of the things she talked about was a disease that sounds like forsythia. Now, forsythia is a bush with yellow flowers. That's not a medical condition, but I could figure it out. So to be empowered is a very big word, right? And it sounds like you have to be empowered. You're smart. You can do this. Guess what? You need help. Here is what help can look like a notepad and a pen. Just write things down. Have your doctor write them down for you. I'm showing this cute little notepad because it can be very simple. It doesn't have to be digital. It doesn't have to be sophisticated, but it's a tool that you need. So we have the relationship and we have the information. Now we're moving on to probability. That sounds like, okay, probabilities are boring. Well, maybe, but what if you had breast cancer and now they're offering you treatment? I think you want to know what's the probability of the treatment working. Because if the probability of the treatment working is 3%, then you may think whether or not you want it. And I never say you should take it if it's above a certain threshold or not. It's up to you. It's up to you. It's your body. It's your preferences. What I am adamant about is that you have to receive this information and in ways that you understand it.
I'm going to spend a little bit more time on probabilities because I think you talk about this in the book, probabilities, percentages, numbers in general can be confusing. How do you suggest we try to navigate through those probabilities, percentages, and numbers? It's not just about, it's a little bit more nuanced, right?
Of course. Yeah. So we can ask and we should ask. But a number of things, sometimes because it's complicated and sometimes just because the information isn't all that available necessarily to our doctors, maybe they just don't have it, we should ask. For example, to keep on with our breast cancer example. So if this were my case, if 100 women in my condition get this treatment, how many will benefit? Maybe everyone. That's great. Maybe 3. And then I need to decide what's happening. And if my doctor doesn't know, that's a question that deserves an answer. Because I'll tell you what the alternative is. We go to system one, to that quick and dirty way of thinking and saying, well, it's a treatment. It's going to help me. Gives me hope. I'll do it. It's going to save my life. But what if it doesn't? And what if it has really bad side effects? You should absolutely know. And again, you know, you can always choose whatever you want. It's your body. It's your life. It's your children. It's on you. I can't make a decision for you, but I can definitely insist that you receive information the way you understand it. And it's enough information for you to make an informed choice to say, this is why I'm choosing this. Not because I think it gives me hope and actually I don't know the number, but because I know that this is what it's giving me and I choose to do that.
When looking for a doctor, what are some of the qualities we should be looking for as a person, not just a doctor, but as a person? What are some of those qualities?
So it's really interesting. I take my mom to the doctor a lot and I often see letters, just framed thank you letters on the doctor's walls. So I did some research on that. I analyzed 100 thank you letters that people wrote to clinics and to doctors. And what I found is that people are as likely to thank doctors for their medical care as they are for their personality and demeanor. And it's interesting because when they talk about personality and demeanor, they get very specific. Like they can say things like, Abdul, the nurse, always comes to get me from the waiting room. I really like that he does that. Or the nurse or the doctor sat with me through my examination. They didn't have to do that. I was freaking out. They held my hand. Things like that. They're very specific. But when they talk about the medical treatment, you know what they say? Great care or good care. That's it. Why? Because we're not that great at gauging that. So actually what we do is we can say the doctor was kind to me. The doctor explained things to me in ways I could understand. They expressed emotion and I appreciated that. And that's what we base our decisions off. So to the degree that we have, that we can find information on how good the doctor is medically, that's really important because we want the nice doctor, but we also want the good doctor. And we definitely need to have rapport with our physicians. We need to be able to confide in them. to tell them things that sometimes we feel are embarrassing, like I didn't take my medication, or I've been also using a supplement that you didn't recommend. What do you think about it, et cetera? So to actually have a conversation and to have them treat us as human beings, that's like so vital. And it's not an add-on. That's something that's important for me to say. We could make the mistake and say, this person is supposed to treat you medically. Does it matter if they smile and be kavod, be a grown up? The truth is that when we feel our doctor cares about us as a person, we are much more likely to persist with the treatment. And this is true of people with HIV. This is true of people with diabetes. It's true of people where there are dire consequences if they don't follow up on the treatment. But still, it really depends on whether they feel the doctor cares about them. So when you're choosing a doctor for you, for your children, or for your loved ones, it's really important to know that you feel connected to this person, the doctor as a person, and you're going to get better treatment and better health outcomes.
And what's a non-negotiable?
Definitely, I think respect. Definitely, I think someone who looks you in the eye, says, hi, Jason, what can I do for you today? And you can time me. You can seriously time me when I say, hi, Jason, what can I do for you today? And what brings you to see me today? Now, how long does that take?
So you need to feel you're being heard.
You're being heard. You're being looked at. You're being viewed as a person. There's someone there who cares about you, who is there for you. And the reason why I say you should time this is because it takes very little time. It could take 5 seconds and it makes a huge difference. That's a whole different conversation that happens rather than if I'm your doctor and I say, yes. What do you mean, yes? Like, do you know my name? Do you even care, et cetera? It sets the tone. It's important for me to say that because doctors are strapped for time. So I know there are doctors out there who are listening. I know there are healthcare executives out there who are listening. And I know your first inclination might be to say, I care about patients, but I don't have the time. Well, you do have the time. If it's 5 seconds, excuse me, you do have the time, please. And if you don't, make the 5 seconds. And also, it's going to make a difference in satisfaction ratings and in health. And that's actually someplace where we as patients, we as people, have some power over our physicians. We can write ratings, we can write reviews. And we should be respectful of the constraints therein, but we should also say, I didn't feel I was treated in a humane way, or the doctor dismissed me, or the doctor didn't want to listen to me. And that should just not happen, because you have vital information about your symptoms, about how you feel, about what you've been doing, and someone should listen to you. Obviously, it's a conversation. It's a tango. If there's very little time, then you don't have to tell your entire life story. But if there are things that are crucial for you to convey, please say them. And if the doctor is not listening, not great.
A big part of this is also centered around increasing our own health literacy. Mm-hmm. And you wrote a great piece on MindBodyGreen about this. So they're kind of, you have four areas you touch on. Can you start with the first one, which is what you call system one and system two when it comes to our thought process?
Right. So if you've read the book Thinking Fast and Slow, which is a major bestseller by Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman, I worked with him. I was his postdoc at Princeton University. And he came up with the concept of system one, system two. And system one is a quick way of thinking. It's super efficient when you're making small choices, like what candy to get, what sandwich to get. That's like, okay, looked at this, felt like this, chose based on not a lot of information and a lot of emotion. That's really great when choosing a sandwich. When choosing healthcare, it's a lot less great because it's much more complicated. So when I make a decision such as, do I vaccinate? Do I take the booster? What am I basing it off? Am I basing it off something that's very system one, that's very much hint driven and says things like, this is not natural, or this is given to me by pharma and they only want money. And I've heard these things. I'm not making them up. Or am I saying, you know, yes, it's a vaccination. It is not natural. But if we were living in a fully natural world, we'd not be wearing deodorant. And if we had a tooth infection, we'd just maybe die of it. And that would be so natural, but not so great. And vaccines are developed by pharmaceutical companies and they are for-profit companies. But if I need medication, where am I going to get it? I'm going to get it from a pharmaceutical company. Doesn't mean they're evil. Like the company that sells my coffee is also a for-profit company. It doesn't mean they sell me bad coffee. So that's the type of considerations we need to make when we are looking at health information. If it's very simple, we can tell ourselves, you're using system one now, and you know what? This is important enough for you to use system two. So that's one thing. The other thing relates to confirmation bias. Now, what does that mean? That means that when we have an opinion or hypothesis, and it can be based on a lot of things or based on nothing at all, we have this opinion. It's ours. We're attached to it. We like it. And don't you dare show me anything that contradicts it, because that means I'm wrong and I don't like to be wrong. Is that always benefiting my health? I'm not so sure. So what do? We go into our little echo chambers. We go into places where people say the same things as we already think. And we believe this is proof that we were right. And it feels great. But is it really also great for our health? I'm not so sure. So again, when we're doing that, let's just try to stop in our tracks for a moment and say, okay, have I heard anything different? Have I looked for information that maybe contradicts what I'm thinking? Let me just look at it for a moment and see if it makes sense. That's like withholding our confirmation bias. And it's hard. Is it we have this human tendency to save cognitive effort and use system one to rely on the confirmation bias. And we have to stop ourselves and say, this is important enough. I'm going to go against my tendency and actually think this through. So yeah, that's the second thing. And you're going to tell us what the third and fourth things are.
Yeah. So ask for clarification. That's next up.
That's crucial. So we talk about health literacy. That's a quality that some of us have and some of us don't have. But guess what? All of us could get sick. So sometimes we don't understand. Rather than be embarrassed about it, rather than make the mistake of thinking, well, doctors didn't think I'm stupid. Just ask. Ask. You're talking about this. Is this the new medication you're prescribing? You're prescribing it to me for atrial fibrillation. What is that? I don't even understand the name of this condition. What does it mean? What does it do? And that's absolutely fine to ask simple questions. It's also super fine and even recommended to say, could you explain this in simple terms? And by the way, when you're visiting the doctor with a child, that's even more important, because children, if they need to be part of their own medical care, sometimes it's a huge challenge. They need to do things that are good for their health and they don't understand why they don't feel like doing it. You can blame them, right? But if they understand that this is for their own good and what it means in terms, in ways that they can understand it, our children are not stupid. They can be small people with not a lot of medical vocabulary, if at all, but they can understand if spoken to in ways that will resonate with them. So definitely we need to ask for clarification for ourselves and also for our children. That's why, you know, when you spoke about my book and you said it's for patients, I'm like, no, it's for people, right? Your life depends on it. It's for everybody, because we all encounter these situations. You sit in the doctor's office with your kid and turns out they have diabetes. They have to understand what it means. Otherwise, it's just going to be a major battle with them. So you have to have this level of clarification.
And as a parent, there's nothing more stressful than being in a doctor's office or a hospital with a kid who's not well. It is just, it's tough. It is very tough.
Of course. And I want to give you another trick. And it's important. You know, I said, this is not for being sick. This is not about being sick. This is about being empowered in our health. Super crucial. So ask three simple questions. Are you ready? I call this ask about what matters. And it starts with, what are the risks of whatever it is that I'm being offered to do, a procedure, a medication, etc.? What are the risks? What are the benefits? And what are the alternatives? And these are crucial. So you start with the risks, because that's a great way of countering the confirmation bias. The doctor says, Mr. X, you have to do this. And you start thinking, okay, I have to do this. Wait, let's listen to the risks. If there are risks involved and want to know about them and want to weigh them, what are the benefits? That's usually pretty apparent. And what are the alternatives? That's a great question. It's great from an informational perspective that you get to hear what else you could do. You know, it removes the confirmation bias. Instead of saying, the doctor said I should do X, I'm going to do X, you suddenly say, the doctor said I should do X, but actually I could also do Y, and I need to think about it. I need to weigh them. So that's the information. And it's also a wonderful question from a relationship perspective. Because if we train ourselves to think about alternatives, then we are not in a position where we say, well, I can't ask my doctor about alternatives to what they're proposing, because that's just disrespectful. This doesn't mean I don't trust them. No, it just means you're being educated and informed and empowered. And I offer three simple questions because I know it's hard. And you know, you sit with your kid at the doctor's office or God forbid at the hospital, you're freaking out. This is not the time for me to offer something super elaborate, because guess what? You can't do that. That's absolutely fine. I totally understand it. So let's do something simple, but very effective. Risks, benefits, alternatives.
And I'll come back to your last point on health literacy. Mm-hmm. You say, use your judgment and acknowledge the element of uncertainty.
Yes. You know, you said, you mentioned COVID. How can we not? It's a moving target. What we now know of COVID is different. COVID itself is different. Our means of dealing with COVID are different. And we're talking about a span of under 2 years. There's a lot of uncertainty involved, and it's fine. That's just life. So we have to acknowledge that and learn to live with that and think of, what can I tolerate? And if I'm falling for something that seems certain, if someone's selling me, quote unquote, this certain cure, is this for real? Because last I heard, reality was quite complicated and had a lot of uncertainty involved. So that's something that is really hard, because we want the for sure answer, and oftentimes that's the wrong answer.
And how do you think about second opinions, maybe third opinions? When should we go for a second opinion? When is it necessary? When is a third opinion? I know, again, that's very nuanced, but how do you think about second opinions?
I think when you ask your own doctor about alternatives, you're almost forcing them to give you a second opinion. So that's a form of doing that. And I'm proposing that before going to a second opinion, because that's just crucial. I have actually another way of doing that, which is very cool. And that happens, and sometimes you said a lot of your listeners are women. I belong to that minority too, and I say minority even though we're 51% of the population, because we're considered, no, you're just a woman. If you're complaining of something, you're probably hysterical. Maybe it's psychological. Maybe it's in your mind. And we encounter a lot of this implicit bias. And a way of encountering that, again, since you asked about second opinion, is when a doctor says something like, this could be psychological, or, you know, I'm really in pain, et cetera, and feel that you're being dismissed, it's great to ask, could there be another medical explanation? So it's a medical explanation. It's not the same as telling me it's all in your head. Thank you very much. It's an actual medical evidence-based information. So that's not even second opinion from a different person. It's from the same person. It's kind of helping the doctor get away from their own confirmation bias. And you know, to answer specifically about second opinion, I think if you don't necessarily trust your doctor, they're offering something where the risks are huge or large, or you feel uncomfortable with what they're offering, then definitely legitimate to seek second opinion. Just make sure you seek it from someone who is credible. And make sure that you also accept reality. Sometimes reality is not fun, no matter how many opinions you're going to get.
Yeah, and from a personal experience, there's nothing worse than having a doctor look at you like you're crazy, like your symptoms aren't real. You know, we've done a whole series on MindBody Green called Invisible Illness, which is a real thing where, you know, whether it's autoimmune or something rare, and there aren't good answers. And there's just nothing worse than a doctor looking at you like you're crazy and saying, well, there's nothing wrong with you. It must be in your head, or you're fine, or, and that's just, it's not fun. And I've been there.
Yeah. It is not fun at all. I happen to work with and know people who are in rare disease, rare patient groups. And they talk about the moment of diagnosis as a moment of huge relief. Because that's the moment you switch from, you're making this up, it's all in your head, this is not real, et cetera, to there is such a condition. You're not crazy on top of not feeling great and just being acknowledged. And that really is huge. That's huge. We talk about health literacy. We always think about it in the context of the patient. In fact, health literacy also has a component of looking for information. And I write in the book about the Zumba disease. That's not a real thing. It's not a real disease. I made it up, but it's something that pained my daughter. I called it the Zumba disease. And her doctor needed to come up with enough health literacy to find what was going on. Now, did he? Didn't he? I'm not going to tell you. Did we find a cure to the Zumba disease? You have got to read my book to figure it out. But it's just, you know, it's a beautiful and really sad wake-up call of this isn't just about us. It's about people. Doctors are people too.
And also, again, I'm speaking from personal experience, and I'm going to segue to your personal experience, but I also think it's important to listen to your gut in this process. You know, the doctor is telling me this thing, but it just doesn't sit right, or it doesn't feel right. And, you know, it's going to second opinions. Sometimes things are crystal clear and doctor says X and that makes sense. And sometimes it doesn't. And not that everything, every diagnosis or every interaction has to feel 100% right. It doesn't, because there are also tons of medical mysteries and sometimes we're just disconnected from what's going on. But I think that's also important to know. That's something that I take into consideration. But I'm also curious how you think about that and how, in doing the research and doing what you do, mm-hmm. how have you changed your interactions with doctors and how, what does that process look like? How has it changed?
So I've been very fortunate to have doctors that I've been working with for a very long time that I have a relationship with. Who I feel care about me, who are available to me. I never abuse this, but they are there. I trust them. My daughter used to complain about our pediatrician. She said, Mom, he's so chill. It's like he doesn't care. I said, I have seen him in situations where he was the opposite of chill, because he knows that not every mom with the diarrhea is cause for alarm, but sometimes, or child with diarrhea, but sometimes you have to be alarmed. And that's when he gets alarmed. So I choose to work with doctors that I trust, that I care about, and that I feel also care about me. And that's really important. And it really goes back to the point of relationship and trust. And basically, when someone says something that doesn't resonate with you, are you in a place where you can say, you know, doctor, I hear you, but I'm not sure, because it's not taking into account the fact that I also have headaches, or this happens more on days when I eat corn, or whatever weird things might be happening. It's like, are you listening? Are you taking everything into account, doctor? And are you giving me a good answer that's tailored to me? Or is this just a cookie cutter answer and it's not good enough? It's legitimate for us to say, to voice our concerns. Again, taking into account the doctor's constraints, they don't have a lot of time. We have to be very concise. But we deserve answers. It's, you know, I call my book, Your Life Depends on It, What You Can Do to Make Better Choices About Your Health. Hello, this is your body. You only have one shot at using it, the best we know.
So what was the most surprising research you came across while writing the book?
I came across quite alarming research. I mean, everything was incredibly fascinating. I'll give you two pieces. One has to do with the conversations around end of life. And I realized nobody wants to talk about end of life. And in fact, nobody does talk about end of life, not even doctors whose patients are dying. Basically, it's the thing that we don't discuss at all. But sadly, we're all going to die, and we should make our end of life preferences known to the people we care about, because we might go hiking and fall off a cliff, and then they need to decide what to do with us. Because we're not yet dead, but we're not fully alive, and we can't say what we want. So that's something that I suggest doing, and I suggest having these conversations around milestone birthdays where we're already contemplating life and where we arrived and what have we accomplished. And that's one thing that I write about, and really the surprising part was to what degree these conversations are avoided. The other bit is, you know what, there are two bits. One is that doctors will admit to overprescribing because they are afraid of being sued, and also because there's money to be made in procedures. That's a bit scary. That really goes to show us that we need to be mindful of what we're being offered. And in other cases, 59% of doctors say, I overprescribe because the patient wants that. So that's the flip side of being a healthcare consumer. So we're assertive and we think we're knowledgeable. We can demand that CT or that whatever. But is it really to our benefit? That's a good question. So you have a lot of power as a patient. You have a lot of information at your fingertips. You can rate the doctor. You can write a letter of complaint. You're powerful. But is this your goal, to assert your power over your doctor, or is your goal to have good health? That's really something for us to consider. And the last nugget that I found, and I loved it, I read about healthcare system in Utah that changed their entire way of handling health. They turned it around. They were very committed. They decided to put clients in the center in every possible way. And that really changed things. It took them years. It changed things. It also changed their rating. And they were bringing in more money. And that's important. That's important for me to say, not because money is why I came to study medical decision making or to consult healthcare companies or to speak about this, but because we live in a commercial world. And if you show commercial companies that they can make a buck when treating us better, they're more likely to do that than if you say, well, just do the right thing. That's nice, but you're going to make a profit. Your ratings will go up. You'll have less lawsuits. You'll have more income. Now they're listening.
So in closing, what is the number one thing you recommend for all of our listeners in terms of what they can do to have a better relationship with their doctor or healthcare professional? What's the takeaway that you want everyone to leave with, if there's one?
I want you to take good care of your health. I hear a lot of frustrated doctors saying, why do I have to push my patients to do this, to work out, to quit smoking, to keep a healthy weight, etc.? It's your body. You're not doing this for your doctor. You are doing this for yourself. So please take good care of yourself and exercise preventive medicine before you have to exercise actual medicine and disease care.
Well, that is comforting, because our audience is a healthy bunch. They're eating well, they're exercising, they're definitely not smoking, they're doing all the right things. So for a show that's, you know, for some people, tough subject, because we're all pretty healthy and no one likes to think about, you know, being ill, we close on an upbeat note. So I love it, because we're a healthy bunch here, my buddy Green. Talia, thank you so much.
My absolute pleasure. I would love to hear from your audience when they read the book and when they listen to the podcast. I'm at taliamyronchats@gmail.com, or taliamyronchats.com is my website, with a lot of resources on health, on nudges, on health inequities. And I would love to have your bunch. Just enjoy that.
Thank you, Talia.